opening our eyes with the torchlight of transcendental knowledge. What does that mean? Does it mean he touches us and we feel some electric shock and we get some relaxation? No such thing. Guru means one who teaches according to the standard system of knowledge given in Shastra and Scripture. This is Vedic Scripture, Srimad Bhagavatam, the topmost Vedic tradition. Now, there are many gurus in modern society, there are many people posing as gurus. But real guru means one who gives actual knowledge according to Shastra, Scripture. So the main duty of a guru is not to smile nicely in a camera, to hold roses and flowers, to impart imaginary electric shocks, but to give knowledge according to Scripture. And this is Srila Prabhupada's greatest contribution. Maybe you know Srila Prabhupada, the founder acharya of ISKCON, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, traveled around the world 14 times in his old age. He opened many temples of Radha Krishna all over the world. He brought Krishna consciousness to the whole world. He opened farms, schools, started distribution of prasadam, sanctified vegetarian food. He did so many things for spreading Vedic culture and specifically Krishna consciousness. But he himself said that my most important contribution is my book. That means in his book, Srila Prabhupada has given the eternal spiritual knowledge of the Vedas in a manner which is absolutely presentable, clear, and understandable to modern man, not that he compromised. That is the defect of so many so-called gurus. They compromise the truth in order, they think, to get many followers. But what is the value of compromised followers? Prabhupada wanted to present the absolute truth as it is. The absolute truth, according to the Vedic literature, in the ultimate word, is Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This Prabhupada presented in his book without any compromise. He translated the Vedic literature and through his disciples had them printed and published in English and in all after that so many different languages of the world, just to give people knowledge of their actual position. Everyone is in ignorance. Everyone is born in ignorance. Abodhadataha, everyone in this material world is born in ignorance. But when we get actual transcendental knowledge from a self-realized person who, by the very fact of his being self-realized, is fixed in knowledge of Shastra, then our ignorance recedes and we gradually become enlightened in the transcendental knowledge that we are all the eternal servants of Krishna, we are not these bodies. So this Srila Prabhupada presented in his book. Prabhupada traveled around the world ceaselessly, tirelessly, preaching the message of Krishna, inspiring his disciples, teaching his disciples, organizing this movement of Krishna consciousness. The most amazing thing is that at night, when all his disciples collapsed, exhausted, and sleep around him, he went on writing his books. This is the time when he wrote his books. And in this way, he wrote about 70 books this time, authentic translations with commentaries of the ancient Vedic scriptures, which are as essential, if not more so, in human society at this time than at any other time. More so, because never has human society been more confused than it is now. So Srila Prabhupada gives his books as his greatest contribution. Bhagavad Gita as it is, Srimad Bhagavatam, teachings of Lord Chaitanya, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Letter of Devotion, these are the main books that he translated, also Sri Yuksha Upanishad, and many other books which were based on the Vedic literature. They were commentaries on different facets of Vedic knowledge. Now, I remember when I first saw this Bhagavad Gita as it is, I was surprised. How can we call it Bhagavad Gita as it is? It's surprising. It's as it is. What does it mean, as it is? It's just like if you buy a
a pair of socks in the shop. You don't see socks, real socks, socks as they are. Or if you go to buy an apple, the person selling them doesn't say, it's really, really an apple. It's just presumed that if you buy an apple, it's an apple. If you buy socks, it's a pair of socks. Why then, on Bhagavad Gita, did Prabhupada write Bhagavad Gita as it is? The reason is because so many people before him had translated Gita into English, more than 300 translations even before Prabhupada translated. But they were translating Bhagavad Gita as it is not, as it isn't. In other words, they were taking the verses of Bhagavad Gita and giving some commentary which is not in consonance with what Krishna taught. What Krishna taught is very clear, not difficult to understand. Krishna speaks of Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Dhyana Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga, different types of yoga, the yoga of work, the yoga of knowledge, the yoga of meditation, the yoga of devotion. But it's very clear from the text of Bhagavad Gita itself what the essence of Gita is. At the end of Gita, Krishna says, Sarva Guhyatanum Bhuya Chinume Paramangvataha. Now I will teach you the most confidential teaching of all, which is my supreme instruction, which is Manmanaha Bhavamad Bhakto Madhyaji Nangamaskuru Manuvaikati Satyante Satyajane Priyoshime. Always think of me, become my devotee, worship me, bow down before me. In this way you will surely come to me. Krishna speaks to Arjuna. I promise you this, Arjuna, Krishna says, because you are my very dear friend. And actually, as is understood on all, by all commentators in the Gita, that Krishna, through Arjuna, is instructing everybody. So, always think of me, become my devotee. Krishna is clearly saying, be my devotee. Bhaktya mama vijanati, elsewhere in Gita, Krishna says, only by devotion can I be known. And that he is to be known, that is also mentioned in the Gita, Vedaisvikara, aham eva vedyaha. Krishna says, in all the Vedas, or the books of knowledge, or the bodies of actual knowledge for the universe, the object, the ultimate object of knowledge is Krishna. In the Vedas, many, many different topics are taught, but the actual topic that is to be understood above and beyond and central to all topics is Krishna. And that we should be his devotees is explaining Bhagavad Gita because he is the Supreme Absolute Truth. Our constitutional position as spiritual is to be his servant. His constitutional position is to be served. He is God, we can serve him. Now, there have been over 300 editions of the Gita in English, but not a single person had even got an idea that we should become a devotee of Krishna by reading even any of these editions. And certainly no one had taken up the life of devotion to Krishna, which is the actual purpose of speaking Bhagavad Gita by Krishna. But after Prabhupada gave Bhagavad Gita as it is, which means it's actually Bhagavad Gita, so many people all over the world took up the path of Krishna consciousness. They became devotees of Krishna, as Krishna said, by thinking of him, bowing down before him, satasam sutra yantaman, engaging in constant glorification of him. But Prabhupada wanted to make a distinction that you may think, well, there are so many Gitas, I read this edition, that edition, it's all the same. No. This is actually Bhagavad Gita because it represents the message of Gita. And other people are taking the name of Krishna because Bhagavad Gita is a famous book, putting his name, and then they put all their own rubbish ideas and call it Bhagavad Gita just to sell the book. But that's not what Bhagavad Gita is spoken for. Krishna didn't speak Bhagavad Gita just so all different so-called philosophers, Prabhupada used to call them philosophers, just so that all these different people who actually don't know what the truth is, they don't know what Bhagavad Gita is, but they want to show themselves as big scholars by making some commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, which is useless because it doesn't fulfill the purpose of Bhagavad Gita by giving people knowledge of Krishna and instructing them to become devotees of Krishna. So because Prabhupada gave the message of Bhagavad Gita as it is, therefore it is potent. These books are alive. These books are transforming people's lives all over the world because Srila Prabhupada is a pure devotee of Krishna and he is purely represented the message of Gita, not interpreted. He simply represented the message of Krishna as it is, without any personal motive. Prabhupada wasn't writing so he could become famous as a big scholar, or he wasn't writing to try to seduce some sycophant stupid followers, but he wants you to give people what is the actual truth, what is the essence, what is the real meaning of our life, which is to know Krishna and love him. And he did that by the strict, authorized system given, that is called Guru Parampara, that knowledge, Vedic knowledge, is spoken at the time of creation by Krishna to Brahma, the first living being, and handed down from guru to disciple, unchanged. Prabhupada wanted to present that. He did so very faithfully, and as a result, his books are full of spiritual potency. There's no hocus pocus in these books. There's no mystical, sounded, meaningless sentences. Prabhupada states everything very clearly because the truth is clear. Facts are clear. I mean, the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita, certainly there are many complex points to be understood, but the actual essence is very clear. There's no need to write mystical kind of sentences to obfuscate the issue. The actual issue is that we are all a fellow servants of Krishna. And that Prabhupada has presented his book. He has presented the science of knowledge of Krishna in so many volumes. We have more than 70 volumes of his book, which explains the science of Krishna in great detail. As the Srimad Bhagavatam says, Bhagavat Tattva Vijnanam Mukta Sangatya Jayate. By understanding this knowledge of Bhagavat Tattva Vijnanam, that means scientific knowledge of the personality of Godhead, but simply by understanding that, we are liberated from material contamination. So Bhagavad Gita gives the essential spiritual knowledge of our spiritual identity as eternal living beings, eternal spiritual beings, eternal servants of Krishna, the supreme absolute truth personality of Godhead. That is presented in essence in Bhagavad Gita, and that same knowledge is expressed in great detail in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is considered the most important book of Vedic knowledge. Bhagavad Gita is 700 verses, Srimad Bhagavatam is 18,000 verses. Srila Prabhupada personally commented on, translated, and explained most of these verses, and left some of the verses for his disciples to translate. So the whole Srimad Bhagavatam in 12 cantos is also available from Srila Prabhupada, Vaishnava commentary, actual authorized commentary from Srila Prabhupada and his disciples. Srila Prabhupada also translated Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the Nectar of Devotion, by Rupa Goswami Prabhupada, who is the principal follower of Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is Krishna, come again to teach us how to be devotees of Krishna. Krishna told in Bhagavad Gita, you should be devotees of me. Krishna came again as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to demonstrate personally how to do that. So Rupa Goswami was the leader of the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, who wrote many, many books based on the different scriptures, which explain categorically the highest path of devotion to Krishna. So among the books of the Goswamis, maybe the most important, especially for beginning devotees, which means most devotees, is the Nectar of Devotion, which explains why devotional service to Krishna is the topmost path for all human beings, how to practice it, and what is the ultimate result of practicing that, what is the perfection of life, and how to enter into that and appreciate that. So this book also, Srila Prabhupada has translated, a very, very valuable book, Nectar of Devotion. And then Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is the biography, one of the major biographies of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, another very big book, which is mostly in Bengali though, very, very sweet book, which explains the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is itself the essence of Vedic knowledge, but the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam is pure, concentrated, loving devotion to Krishna, which is expressed in the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It also has the philosophy of Krishna consciousness encapsulated, and the highest understanding of Krishna, which is Rasa Jnana, which is mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam. Tatshringatam Rasa Jnanam Swadhi Swadhi Pade Pade. Srimad Bhagavatam explains that those who hear the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, they get knowledge of the rasa, or the sweet experience of devotional mellows of Krishna, and they relish that at every step of their life. So actually these scriptural books are so wonderful, so sweet, so clear, so revealing about the actual purpose of life. And it was literally an eye-opener for so many people all over the world. That what is the purpose of life? And there's so many people all over the world to this day who, by reading Srila Prabhupada's book, their whole lives simply change. They understand that actually my life is meant for serving Krishna. Just a few days ago I was in Russia. I met one lady from a small town in a remote region of Russia. And somehow or other one day, devotees of Krishna came to her town selling the book of Srila Prabhupada. She got that book, she read it, she saw the address, Moscow, Center for Krishna Consciousness. So she saved up some money because a lot of people in the country don't have a lot of money, and took a train 1500 kilometers to Moscow, went there, spent a few days there, and found out everything about Krishna consciousness, in essence, how to chant with deeds, how to offer food at home, all these different things. She found out, she went home, and now she's practicing Krishna consciousness fully. Another lady, after I was in Russia, I went to the Czech Republic, and recently our devotees there, they met a lady who, 9 years ago, she read Prabhupada, she got Prabhupada's book, and then she ordered more, and she got a whole set of Prabhupada's books, and from reading the book, she's following everything about Krishna consciousness in her life. These books speak soul to soul. Srila Prabhupada, who is a pure devotee of Krishna, has given Krishna in these books. And people who read them can understand and become enlightened in the science of Krishna by reading these books. Therefore, in our Krishna conscious movement, under the direction and order of Srila Prabhupada, we very strongly emphasize the distribution of these books, because we know how much value there is. It's not like ordinary books, these are not the kind of, you know, you buy a novel and you throw it away or you stick it in the bookshelf. But these books are required, they're spiritual food. Just like every day you have to eat a meal. That way, Amarina, touch my shoes with a vein in my heart. Before we speak, we offer our respectful obeisances to our Guru Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada, because he has opened our eyes, which were in the darkest of dark ignorance. Now, in the modern age, there's a lot of propaganda how we're making progress, and it's the age of knowledge and information and technology and all these things. And in some ways, it's true. We have a lot of information to get on the internet and find out more or less anything you want to find out about anything in this material world, from the breeding habits of frogs to the interplanetary motions of the cosmos. You can find out so many things. We've made so much progress. Nowadays, people just think it's completely normal to hop on a plane and hop off a few hours later on the other side of the world, things that people couldn't have dreamed about. So definitely there's a lot of knowledge and a lot of technology, and it's called progress. But there's something missing, there's something wrong. Something very wrong in human society. And it wouldn't take a PhD genius to understand there's something seriously wrong. News, you look in the news on TV or you look in the newspaper, news means pretty much it's all bad news. And even the good news, which the politicians say, they're giving you some good news, it's just some propaganda to promote their political campaign. Despite all our so-called progress, there's something basically very, very wrong with human society. I remember as a kid, I was brought up in England. So, let's see, I must have been going to school starting in the mid-1960s. So there was still this kind of euphoria about how by progress we're going to become a very happy society and everyone would become nice and good, because it was considered that in the past people were nasty and mean and bad, because they weren't educated. But then when people become educated, automatically they should become very peaceful and very good. So we see there's mass education in many parts of the world, but still there's mass madness going on, more or less what's going on in human society. I don't even call it real sanity what's going on. You see the whole human society, people are educated, they're running around, what for? Simply to gratify their senses. This is the term Srila Prabhupada used to use. We're trying to gratify the senses. Our whole life is dedicated to gratifying the senses. In other words, we always seem to have to put something on our tongue. Nowadays, I see in India, it's a big fashion. Everyone has to chew some gum all the time, as if that made them something special. Before, They used to chew pan and spit it in the corner now, and now it's all very high class to chew gum. And they end up taking the tennis stars and the, you know, again, they're trying to be Westerners. So, tongue always needs something, always has to be eating something, or smoking something, drinking some tea, eating some biscuit, always trying to satisfy the tongue. And then the ears, you always have to be listening to some music. We have the radio, or we have, we walk around, the people walk around with their headsets on, listening to some music. And so the eyes, there's so many things. The TV is more or less for the sense gratification of the eyes. There's so many things you see on TV. Beauty contest, this is very popular in India now, although apparently it's pretty much out of fashion in the Western world where they got fed up with beauty contest. But India is always trying to imitate the West, and they're always, don't mind me saying so, they're always at least 20 years behind. They think they're on the highest platform of fashion, following something which is already considered useless and finished in the West. So beauty contest, you have Miss Dilipali in Bombay, Miss Bihu, and then they come together and have Miss Bombay contest, and then Miss India, and then they go to this Miss Universe, so everyone's looking on the TV, like some, just like you see all the dogs when there's a bitch in season, they all surround with their tongues hanging out, so like that. So something interesting for the eyes, especially, and it all leads up to this sex sensation, touch sensation, the highest sense gratification of the material world is the interaction of one body with another. That's partly the basis of modern civilization. Everything is advertised. With you see some beautiful woman with a toothpaste, use this toothpaste, and there's a picture of a beautiful woman. I guess the women are supposed to think if you use this toothpaste, you'll become like a beautiful woman. And the man is supposed to think that if you use the toothpaste, the beautiful woman on the ad's going to jump out and kick you. It's all bluffing, of course. The toothpaste, you know, just washing the teeth. The toothpaste, that's all. But everything is advertised. They don't say, everything is advertised with some beautiful young woman, you can, cigarettes are advertised if you smoke your cigarette, some beautiful young woman is standing on the poster, and you smoke a cigarette and no beautiful woman comes. But somehow you have the idea that it's going to make you sexy, attractive, and the whole world is, they're promoting this sexual attraction. This is, for all our education and progress, the whole human society, the basic motive is simply how to enjoy the senses, which, quite frankly, the animals are doing quite well without all these things. You see, just like the dogs and the cats, they're also enjoying sex life. They don't have, maybe not so sophisticated, they don't have sophisticated pornography and fashions and so many things, but they're enjoying life in the so-called enjoyment. What is the enjoyment? Simply rubbing of one body against another. What is a body? A body is, you examine what is the body, we decorate, I mean, not me, I mean, I decorate with these tree legs, but other people are decorating with lipstick. Lipstick means they get some fat of some animal, and they put a few chemicals in, and then you rub it on. Beautiful, and makeup, and there's something for your eyelashes, and something for your eyelids to make them look bigger, and saying different colored lipstick, different colored cream for your face. You have to put cream on your face to try and make you look 30 when you're actually 97 years old, and you have to try and look young and attractive, and all these different, so many different things to make your body attractive. But actually, what is the body? The body is simply a band, a strip. And inside, well, there's that thing, isn't it? Beauty is skin deep. Take off the skin, and what have you got? You imagine, most beautiful, so-called most beautiful women in the world. Just imagine with the skin off, how beautiful it would be. You think people are going to stick the picture on the wall? You think you want to embrace a body with all the blood oozing out? I mean, it may sound very crude and gross, but that is the reality. We are attracted to some body which is simply a bag of bones and blood and liver and pus and excreta and urine, and that's what the body is all about. And this is advertised as the greatest happiness in human society, love, romance, sex, all these things. But the dogs on the street are doing it. So what is the progress of human society? For all our education and all our progressive scientific technological advancement, people are living like cats and dogs. And how are they going to be happy? Because by the grace of God, we do have more intelligence than the human form of life. But that intelligence is meant to be used to understand him, that is given by God so that we can understand that we're supposed to come to a higher platform beyond that of the animal. In the Vedic verses, so we understand that we get this human form of life after many, 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 many births. We take many births with dogs and cats and caterpillars and frogs and hedgehogs and snakes and worms and trees and so many different forms of life. But only in the human form of life do we have enough intelligence, through the developed intelligence, to think what actually is the purpose of life, what is the meaning of life. So that intelligence is supposed to be used to inquire, why am I suffering in this material world? How to get free from suffering? How to understand God? How to understand Krishna? But instead we're just using it, no doubt, very intelligent, making space rockets, atom bombs, super cooling technology, and so many different things. So it requires a lot of intelligence, but it's all based on a mistake. The mistake that we can be happy simply by developing on the material platform. But whatever you do on the material platform, however sophisticated you may be, however many PhDs you may have after your name, however fantastic your technology is, even if you can go to the moon in a spacecraft, which we doubt we ever went anyway, but even if you can, so what? Even if you can travel by spacecraft to Mars, how is that going to help you? Is it going to make you happy? So many people, you go to Bombay, Madras, Calcutta, or Delhi, any four places, Indian embassy, American consulate in India. Every day, long lines of people, they want to go. They're thinking, we'll go to America, we'll be happy there because it's more developed. What is the happiness? Some people in America are happy. Some people are dancing in the streets out of joy because we're American, life is so wonderful. Come on, that's wonderful. In America also, there's so many suicides, murders, and the whole society is so competitive. People are so divorced, like anything, left, right, center. People, I love you forever. We promise to love each other forever. I live with you forever. And then 3 years later, you know, well, I'm going to live with someone else forever now. And 5, 6 divorces, not uncommon. So these are all things of society that is not simply unhappy, but grossly disturbed and unhappy. Even people, they say unhappy, but inside there's so much anxiety and suffering. It's like a social cliche. Everyone has to show you're happy. You have to say no problem, and you have to show a big front that, yeah, I'm on top of the world, everything is great, everything is wonderful. But inside people are suffering. People are full of anxiety. Because they're trying to be happy on a false platform. They're trying to be happy on the platform of sense gratification. That's how we're trained from birth. We go to school, we're taught that learn, get your degree, get a job, get promotion, have a good career, be a success. Even before you go to school, your parents are pumping you, learn your ABCs, and our kid has to become a doctor, and go to America, and be a big guy, and earn lots of money. And the whole society is priming you like that. Everyone's priming you to be a big so-called success. So where is the success? Where is the happiness? Good job. What is a good job? Good job means after working like a dog to get your so-called wonderful degree, you simply have to work day and night to earn lots of money, which you don't have time to so-called enjoy anyway. Go to America and be a big guy and earn lots of money. And the whole society is priming you like that. Everyone's priming you to be a big so-called success. So where is the success? Where is the happiness? Good job. What is a good job? Good job means after working like a dog to get your so-called wonderful degree, you simply have to work day and night to earn lots of money, which you don't have time to so-called enjoy anyway. People are unhappy. How can they be happy in a society which just pushes you to work, 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 in quest of a dream that you'll be happy by getting lots of money and then you can enjoy having a big car and a big house and all these things, which never made anyone happy anyway. It's all a big bluff. The whole society is just cheating from the beginning of life to end. And if you try to say anything or do anything different, they just say you're crazy, you're a failure, they label you so many names. But actually the whole society, anyone can see it, just based on a big mistake. There's something intrinsically wrong. Despite having all these modern conveniences, just like this TV. I'm not saying it's intrinsically bad, I'm using it too. Just speak this and do something worthwhile should be spoken on TV. But despite having all these things, we're
in a society which is full of suffering. People are not happy. In fact, the more, generally we see, the more technology there is in any society, the more people get disturbed, the more there's social disruption. People are not happy. How can they be happy if they're living like sophisticated cats and dogs? How is it possible? If you have more intelligence, then naturally, in your heart, you're always thinking, actually, what am I doing here? What am I doing? What's it all about? What's the purpose? But because everyone's going on with the drama of being happy and getting ahead and having a good career and happy family and all this kind of, everyone's wrapped up in this drama. Everyone else is doing it and we're thinking, well, I suppose I should be doing it too. You'll see, generally children, they have many good questions. They ask things like, what's life all about and what about God and all these things. But after some time of being in the school system and the general crushing social system, they learn not to ask these questions. Don't think of these questions. But these are the things we should be thinking about. These are the actual questions we should be asking. Who is God? What is the purpose of life? What is the value if you get, big degree, big job, hundreds of thousands of dollars, but you simply live like a dog and die in ignorance like a fool? Educated fool. You know so many things, but you don't even know what the purpose of life is. You don't know what will happen after death. You don't know who you don't know what your actual identity is, who you are. You don't know how to be happy. This is modern life. We're promoting that which is asat. This is the technical Sanskrit word. It means that which is not real, not eternal, false. We're promoting this as reality, that the goal of life is to get ahead. Rat race, we call it a rat race. Good term. All the rats, human-like rats, competing with each other to get ahead and be the top rat or top dog, as they say. But no one's happy in such a life, and it's not possible to be happy. There's a basic mistake. And that basic mistake, where's the answer here in Bhagavad Gita? Bhagavad Gita isn't simply some old book that should be put on the shelf and we offer a pranam or salam and forget it. No, Bhagavad Gita is vital to our life now because it tells us who we are. Who we are spiritual living beings. We're not the body. That is the first lesson of Bhagavad Gita, and that is the basic mistake of human society. We don't understand this very basic thing, that this bag of bones and blood is not me. I am a spiritual, eternal, living being. Before this body came into being, I existed. And after the body dies, after it drops down and is burnt, or the Parsis have the vultures eat it, or the Christians or the Muslims bury it, whatever you want to do with the body, when it's gone, when it drops dead, it's dead, finished. But I, the soul, will continue to be a spiritual being. So if we simply try to mollify the senses of the body, we can never be satisfied. Because we are eternal spiritual living beings, and our real happiness, as we understand from Bhagavad Gita, which is the definitive book of spiritual knowledge, then our real happiness is in relationship with the Supreme Soul, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose name is given as Krishna. Our relationship is with Him as eternal servant. That is on the spiritual platform. This material life is simply an entanglement. We think, I am this body, I have to act in terms of this body, but it will all be over in a short time. I'm thinking I'm this body. Just like I thought in a previous life, I may have had the body of a dog, or I may have had the body of a demigod like Indra in heaven. And at that time when I'm a demigod, I'm thinking, this is me, this is my family, these are my friends, and then we die. We leave that body, we leave the dog body, we leave the cat body, we go to another body. Then we come to the human body, and we think, this is my country, this is my home, this is my family, this is my body. This is ignorance. In one sense it's true, we can't say it's totally untrue. But it's only temporary. We're in these bodies for a very, 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 very short time. We go to another body, and then again we identify with that body. So, if we identify ourselves wholly and solely with this body, then we're acting in ignorance, because we're not, because the body is temporary and I'm eternal, and this is the whole mistake of human society. They've simply identified the individual beings as the bodies they are in. Namaste Saraswate Devi Gauravani Pacharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschasta Deshatarine. Many people ask us if we believe in the theory of reincarnation. Now I always reply that from the very beginning the understanding inherent in such a question is flawed. As soon as you ask, do you believe, we're already on a wrong platform. Because it really doesn't matter what we believe. Just like someone says, do you believe in God? Well, does believing in God make him exist, or not believing in him make him not exist? Is it that if the atheist wakes up tomorrow and says that, well, today I think I'll believe in God, then all of a sudden God exists? No. The existence of God, or the fact of reincarnation, is not dependent on our belief. Either there is God, or there isn't. It doesn't depend on our belief. Either there is reincarnation, that means either when we die, we take birth again, or there isn't. Either one or the other. There's no question of belief making it come into existence, or non-belief making it non-existent. It's got nothing to do with it. So really, it's not a theory of reincarnation either. Either it is, or it isn't. The real thing is to find out what is the fact. Believing that won't help. Not believing also won't help. You have to find out what is the fact. Really, it's important to understand this. I mean, if we consider all the injunctions in the scripture that describe about reincarnation, that, as like in the Bible, Lord Jesus said, for instance, just to show that it's not only in so-called Eastern religions, he said that as you sow, you shall reap. You get a reaction. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It's not only true on the thermodynamic or physical platform, but it's true in karmic reaction also. At least we should investigate that. What is the actual fact? So if we say, I believe or I don't believe in reincarnation, it's a very flimsy platform. We should try to find out what is the real fact. Now you may say, well, how can you know? It has to be a matter of belief, because no one can say what happens after death. But why? Why do you think no one can say? Just because you can't say, or you don't know, doesn't mean that everybody doesn't know. Just because you can't find out by normal, what we consider scientific means, what happens after death, doesn't mean that there isn't some methodology that we can find out. Every investigation, every field of knowledge has its methodology. Just like if you want to study chemistry, well, chemistry, biology, physics, they all have their separate methodologies. If you want to study history, maybe you have to go out and look at some old buildings, investigate old literatures, and try and find out facts about the past. If you want to find out about chemistry, you have to bring some Bunsen burners, test tubes, litmus paper, different methodology for different fields of knowledge. So similarly, for transcendental knowledge, there is a method to find out, but we have to adopt the right methodology. Now, the right methodology that's given in scripture, which deals with transcendental knowledge, is that we should hear from self-realized souls, those who are expert in the field of transcendental knowledge, those who are visibly, manifestly, by their activities, in touch with a higher reality, who do have transcendental understanding that corresponds with others who are self-realized, what their transcendental understanding is. We should hear from self-realized souls. They will explain to us. Now that actually is in any system of knowledge. In the initial stage, we have to have some faith. Just like if you go to school to study mathematics, in the beginning you study arithmetic. Now in the beginning you may not understand when the teacher puts something calculus, some calculation on the blackboard, When you first see it, you don't understand what it is. But if you don't understand it and you just say, well, I don't understand, therefore it's nonsense, well then you can't learn. You have to have some initial faith that the teacher knows what he's talking about, has something relevant to teach. Why do you have such faith? Because the teacher is teaching an accredited subject of knowledge that is approved by others who are expert in the science. He's teaching something which he has learned from other experts. In this way, we accept, in the beginning we don't understand, but in the beginning we accept that even though I don't understand, here is someone who can teach me. So similarly, to understand spiritual knowledge, we have to, in the beginning, have some initial faith. Faith means we don't understand now, but we accept that others do have higher understanding than myself, and that by hearing from them and applying their instructions in our lives, we can also come to understand. This is the way to understand transcendental knowledge also. And that's called the parampara system, that one should hear from one who has heard from another person who is spiritually perfect. But the difference between transcendental knowledge and academic or mundane knowledge is that it affects our whole being. When we're discussing transcendental knowledge, we're discussing that which is to do with the very essence of ourselves or our soul. Now, to get knowledge of that, we have to get knowledge from sources that are above and beyond the ordinary mundane platform. That's why often people think that, well, it's just some hocus pocus or not something we can properly understand, because it can't be properly understood from the mundane platform. We have to come to a higher platform to understand that. So in the beginning, we have to have faith that there is a higher platform. And there's no reason not to believe that there is something super mundane. It would be very limiting to think that simply everything that we can touch, taste, smell, hear, feel, and perceive through our senses, that's the whole scope of reality. Rather, it would be intelligent to consider that beyond that which we can immediately perceive, or even that which we can immediately imagine based on our sense perception, it would be intelligent to think that there may be and most probably is a whole range of knowledge beyond that which we can immediately perceive. We're tiny, tiny living beings in a vast universe. We have no idea what is the extent of the universe or beyond the universe, and we don't really know how it came into being, although I'm talking from our perception, from the mundane perception, just being here on this planet. We can't really understand why it came in, how it came into being, and beyond that, why it came into being, simply by looking through telescopes, microscopes, and making different theories. We may have so many different wonderful theories about the origin of the universe, but why is everything going on? What is our role in the universe? That we can't perceive simply by a mundane investigation. Therefore, we have to come to a level which is beyond the ordinary, beyond that which we can figure out through our own brain power, and take knowledge from a higher source. Now, this is not unreasonable. It was thought at one time in what's called the path of scientific advancement that as we develop science, then gradually we'll come to understand more and more about the universe, and then gradually religious and spiritual ideas will fade away, because there was a theory that religious understanding is simply based on ignorance. That was the theory. Because it's a long history, how in the Western world, originally in the Western world, the Christian church, which later split up into various churches, had a hegemony on knowledge. And they explained that the universe was created by God in 6 days, on the seventh day he rested. This is in the Bible, Genesis. And according to the church fathers, the earth is the center of the universe, and the sun and other planets revolve around it. And then there was it's a whole history, how Copernicus, Galileo, by their observation, they thought, well, this isn't right. And it became challenged. Science challenged the hegemony of knowledge that was held by the church fathers, and then it was apparently proved that they were right, and then gradually it came to be thought that science could explain everything and that religious explanations were just for ignorant people who had no knowledge. So it was thought like that, but we see that today, despite so much advancement of scientific knowledge, there's still good interest in religion. It's not that because science has discovered many things about the universe that people have given up their faith or their inclination towards transcendental knowledge. Even highly educated people are interested in transcendental knowledge because science has its limitations. It can only go so far. It can't explain, for instance, what is the difference between a living body and a dead body? What is the fundamental difference? If it could explain, then presumably we should be able to live forever by scientific adjustment. What is the essential difference between a living body and a dead body? They can't explain that because the difference is the presence or non-presence of the soul. But mundane science can only perceive that which is mundane. The soul is not mundane. So how is mundane science going to find out the soul? Not possible. Therefore, to find out transcendental knowledge, you have to go to a transcendental process. Similarly, science can explain some things about the universe, some things, maybe not as many as it purports to explain. There are many different theories, for instance, about the origin of the universe, but scientists don't know for sure. I was reading in one journal that there are more than 2,000 theories among astrophysicists about the origin of the universe. And of course there are also theories that there was no origin, that it's just going on since time immemorial without any origin. Now that's very interesting. 2,000 theories, of course 2,000 theories means that there would be variations of main general theories. But I thought about that well, how many astrophysicists are there in the world anyway? There are probably not many more than 2,000 in the world. It seems that they all have their own opinion. In other words, they don't really know. And how are you going to know, sitting on this tiny planet at one point in time, some millions and billions of years after the origin of the universe, how are you going to find out how it came into being? You may do different mathematical calculations, but you can't really say. So, transcendental knowledge fills the gap where science comes to its limits. Science also can give us information of the universe, but it can't fill in our emotional needs. Our emotional needs ultimately come from the soul. We have a need to be loved. What is that? How can you explain it? If, according to certain scientific people, that life is simply a combination of chemicals, how do you explain the need for living beings to love each other? A very basic need for love. What is that? Chemicals don't love each other. I'm looking at a TV camera. I can't have a relationship with a TV camera. TV camera is chemicals. The body is also chemicals. What is it? What is that that sparks the need for love? That is the presence of the soul. That is described in Bhagavad Gita and the Vedic literatures, which give the most clear and explicit directions about reincarnation. It's not actually very difficult to understand. Even a child can understand it. It's just a matter of being ready to understand it. Just like Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that dehino svin yatha dehe kumara yovanam jara tatha dehantara praptihi. He explains that there is the body, it's called deha. And within the body is the dehi, which means the inhabitant of the body or the owner of the body, that is the soul. As long as the soul is present in the body is alive. When the soul leaves the body, we say he has died. Although actually the body is only composed of chemicals which are intrinsically dead anyway. If you take, what is this body composed of? So much water, hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, so many different chemicals are within the body. There's no life in hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen. Life is not intrinsically in there. And when the body dies, the body is still a bunch of chemicals. What's the difference between a living body and a dead body? Any language in the world, When someone dies, what do they say? He's gone away. Any language. I put this to different people where I travel in different parts of the world. So do you say this in your language? I just yesterday came from Czech Republic, Prague. So just 2 days ago I was giving a lecture there, and I asked them, of course there's an interpreter, I asked them, do you say this in your language also? I'm sure you do, because in every language of the world they say, he's gone away when someone's dead. But then the question comes, who went away? Because the same body is there, someone may be crying, oh, my father went away. He's there? No, he's gone away. He's there? The body is there? The same body you cared for so much, you kissed, you hugged, you laughed with, you joked with, sometimes your father chastised you, so much affection you had. Now you say, he's gone away. The same body that you so carefully looked after, now you immediately want to burn. Before, if you had burned that same body, you would have protested. Now if you don't burn, they'll protest. Burn, bury, whatever. You have to dispose. It's a dead body. It's the same body. Now how can you say he's gone away? Because it's the same body you focused. He's gone away means the soul has gone away. The soul of the person. That example I was giving from Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that the body and the owner of the body, or the soul, or he who gives life to the body, they are separate. They are only apparently together. As long as the soul is in the body, they say alive. Although actually the body is dead anyway. And when the soul leaves the body, they say he's dead. But actually he's gone away. That is the fact. He's gone away to go somewhere else. Now this example Krishna gives is very interesting. He doesn't just tell us believe, but he gives a good example. He says, just as the body changes from boyhood to youth to old age, so death is also another change. Now just consider this example. Imagine a young boy, 10 years old, somehow or other goes away from home. His mother sees him 20 years later. Immediately she recognizes, oh my son, and cries and embraces him. But who is the son and who is the mother? The body of the son has changed. He may still have the same basic features, but actually the body has changed in so many ways by eating, breathing, respirating, perspirating, passing stool and urine. The body has changed. The chemicals have gone almost complete transformation. You probably won't find in the body of a 10-year-old boy when he's grown up to the age of 30, you probably won't find even one of the same chemicals left. They've all changed. And the mother's body has also changed. Maybe she was 30 years old, now she's 50. So the body has changed completely. And the mind has also changed. The mind is changing at every moment. The mentality of a 10-year-old boy and the mentality of a 20-year-old man is different. So when the mother says, oh my son, who is she referring to? It's not the body that's the same, it's not the mind that's the same, but immediately she recognizes that the person is the same. And this is very interesting because it shows that the person is different from the body and the mind. So that, Krishna says, the person within the body, that gives life to the body, apparent life to the body, is the soul. Krishna explains that the soul travels from body to body to body within this material world. Ishthaya bhutale shimate bhaktivedanta swaminiti namine namaste saraswate deve gauravani pacharine niravishesha shunyavadi paschante deshatane. Today I'm going to talk about sin. If we say this word sin, some people groan. They don't want to think about sin. It sounds like some really old-fashioned word, some kind of word that's used to try and make people behave in some kind of old-fashioned puritanical way. And modern emphasis in society is simply enjoy without restriction. As the saying goes, if it feels good, do it. This is dog philosophy. That's what the dog does. He sees the bitch in the street. It feels good that he should chase after her, so he does it. That's not human life. If it feels good, do it. Human life means one should think very carefully about what he's doing and about what the purpose of life is. He should know what he's doing. He should know what the purpose of life is and act. Every action should be in relationship to the ultimate purpose of life. Now, of course, many people take their purpose of life to be to eat, drink, be merry, and enjoy with the idea that tomorrow we shall all be dead. Enjoy now. You can't enjoy later. That's the idea. So this idea of unrestricted enjoyment is actually based on the atheistic idea that tomorrow we shall all be dead, everything's finished, enjoy now while you can. Who are you to enjoy? If you're going to be dead, who are you? That they don't stop to think. But you are an eternal spiritual being. You're not the body. They don't consider that. According to all these scriptures extant in human society, you get a reaction for everything you do. That's why we have the concept of sin. Sin basically means doing something that is wrong. And sin is followed by punishment. Now, what's wrong? Okay, lying, stealing, murdering, all these things are considered wrong. The Vedic literatures, the Srimad Bhagavatam, defines that there are four mahapataks, or very bad things, which should not be done. They form the basis of all other sinful activities. Four basic things which destroy spiritual consciousness, which is the real consciousness that human beings should be trying to develop in this valuable human form of life. These four things are meat-eating, intoxication, illicit sex, and gambling. Now, these things are so common in modern society that we don't think anything of it. In the Western world especially, most people, even today, although there has been a very big increase in vegetarianism, but still most people are brought up to think that meat eating, absolutely normal. Gambling, okay. Intoxication, drinking, taking tea and coffee, cigarettes, beer, absolutely normal. Illicit sex, jump in one hole, jump down another. It's all the same. Find any hole and use it. In one hole, jump down another. It's all the same. Find any hole and use it. This is quite natural, they think they said natural. But according to the Vedic literatures, especially the Vedic literatures, tell us that human beings should act in a thoughtful way, not simply like an animal. We got this human form of life after going through so many animal bodies where these things, simply eating, sleeping, having sex, fighting, these things go on. That is animal life. There's nothing beyond it. So the human life, human form of life is meant for more than simply ahara nidra bhaya maithunam cha samanime tat pashubhyanaranam. Both in the human form of life and the animal forms of life, eating, sleeping, fearing, all karma works. If you want to enjoy unrestricted sex, well, it's not so easy in human society. It's much easier to do that if you're a monkey. So, the laws of karma, by the grace of God, in the next life you may get a monkey body. You may know that some people, they don't even wait to get a monkey body. When they become old and impotent due to excessive sex, they have monkey's genitals sewn on so they can go on with their sex business. That some famous singer in the Western world who for
reasons of TV propriety, I won't say, but one famous singer who liked to do things his way. He sung, "I'll do it my way." So his way was to get some monkey genitals sewn on so that he could go off so-called enjoying sex up to a late. So people who want to simply indulge in all kinds of sinful acts, then they are punished by the laws of nature by getting animal bodies. That is a punishment. You may think, well, maybe it's nice to be a dog. I don't have to do any work. I just lie on the beach and eat some food. But that is a punishment by material nature, to get the body of a dog or a cat or a monkey, because material life is miserable. You may think, well, if I'm a monkey, it's kind of fun. Jump around, have a lot of sex, have a lot of wives. See the monkey, generally one male monkey. Here in India we see so many monkeys, maybe not here in Bombay, but practically everywhere else in the country. So many monkeys are jumping around all over the place, in the towns, in the country. So you'll see one male has many females. So you may think that's very nice. I'll have a harem. I don't have to become a rich man and work. I'll simply, by virtue, ipso facto, being a monkey, I'll have a harem. But that is a punishment by material nature, because material life is suffering. You have to suffer repeated birth and death, anxiety, disease, again and again and again. Human life is meant for getting free from these sufferings of material. Becoming liberated from birth and death and going to the spiritual world by serving Krishna. That is what human life is meant for. And sinful life means excessive indulgence in that which obstructs our self-realization. That is the core definition of sinful life. Or even to go even further, deeper, sin means that which is not pleasing to Krishna. In the Bible, the concept is given of original sin. The idea is that Adam and Eve sinned, and as a result, the whole human race is suffering up till the present time. Although the Vedic understanding is that each one of us individually is turning away from Krishna. Each one of us has the choice to serve Krishna or not. That choice at least we get in the human birth if we're given information. Just like we're giving information in these TV programs, we're giving information. Who is Krishna? What is our relationship with Him? How about in that relationship? That knowledge is continuously given by Krishna. Either He Himself comes directly to speak, or He sends His empowered representatives in different cultures and countries of the world to teach us, don't get involved in sinful life, go to God, lead a pious life, religious life. So that information is being given by Krishna, but sinful life means to reject the godly life and to live simply for our own selfish, sensual purposes. That is sinful life. That is the basis of sinful life. But, as I was saying, apart from the basic concept of sinful life, which is to not be
surrendered to Krishna, sinful life is closely linked to meat-eating, gambling, intoxication, illicit sex. Yes, these things are sinful, although it's promoted in modern society that you have to use, otherwise you won't be healthy. You can suppose it, because for India we know there have been so many healthy people for so many generations, no matter what meat. They think that if you eat meat, then you've got a good, strong, healthy body. Well, I was brought up eating meat, and I'm pretty skinny, pretty thin. It wasn't that I became sin after becoming a vegetarian. On the other hand, you see some people who are brought up as vegetarians and they don't say they're vegetarian, weightlifting something, for instance. The bear is vegetarian, the elephant's a vegetarian, that's strong. You can't be as strong. You're being the biggest weightlifting champion in the world, even a baby elephant can not do anything. The elephant only eats grass. So it's simply not true, it's a lie. But by eating meat, you become stronger. It's not true. The family people in the Western countries, especially Britain, Australia, America, becoming vegetarians, and so many already became vegetarians because, mainly, because they know it. So, meat is bad news for her. Bad, bad news. That's what we're saying. Cancer risk, heart attack risk, and so many different chemicals are injected in the animals that help before and after slaughter. There are other considerations also. I mean, it's just not nice to eat animals. It causes some pain, of course. Vegetarians, they also eat living beings, plants. Although in many cases, just like if you eat grains, wheat, rice, all these things, they're harvested after the grain becomes ripe, in other words, after they're dead. And fruits can also be taken from trees without damaging the tree, That's designed by nature, you know. So there are so many vegetables and fruits that you actually don't kill the plant to eat and take the food from it. In some cases, the plant is killed, but because the living being in the body of a plant is less conscious than that of an animal, it suddenly causes a lot less suffering. So the living being in the body of the plant to be killed. That is the law of nature. He will do that for even in one living being lives in another. But it's suddenly less violent to take carrots, cabbages, rice, wheat, than to eat the blood and flesh of animals. So that's an ethical consideration. Now, even to take vegetarian food without offering it to Krishna, without offering to represent, that's also considered sinful, because everything should be offered to God, and without doing that, we become implicated in the crime of killing a living being, namely the plant. But it's not as great a thing as eating meat. It's very, very simple. Meat eating means that people have lost the quality of mercy, really. It's so true. Mostly people they die on the spot. They don't see the suffering in them. And those who are slaughtering animals, they just become completely stone happy. They hear the screams of the animals. The animals are not just simply some senseless, inert lumps of flesh. They don't, sometimes you see this, some poster of a smiling cow. But the cow, when you see her slaughter, they're not smiling. They're screaming. It's horrible. It's simple. So, meat eating is simple. Illicit sex is sinful. Illicit sex means sex outside of marriage, and even sex within marriage is simply indulging in some kind of spot. That's not sexual either. Seeing is a very valuable gift has to be conserved within the body for the sake of enriching the brain cells, which can help to develop higher consciousness.
For recreation, no. That's not the purpose. The purpose is given by nature is procreation. Now we try to stop that by contraceptives, abortion. This is sinful because you're denying, contraception means you're denying the soul who is meant to be born in that body by the act of sex. You're denying them the chance. And abortion is grossly sinful because the child is already there in the womb. You may say embryo, but the embryo is alive, otherwise. Alive means it's a living being. You're killing the body in which it's living, denying it the opportunity of a human life. Very sinful. Extremely sinful. Also, sex outside marriage,
Some say very sinful. Marriage means in human society there's marriage. In animal society, there's no marriage. Marriage is meant to be conducted under the eyes of God for living a sane, civilized, human, religious life. So sex before marriage, sex even you're married, you then you have sex with someone else's wife or something. All very, very sinful. Divorce, homosexuality, all sinful, according to Shastra. Shastra means that which is given by God, the laws of God. There are certain rules of the universe. We may think we can flout them, but we get sinful reaction. That's why I'm saying this. It's not simply to bludgeon people into some kind of fear, but we should know what the laws of the universe are, because if we don't follow them, we're going to suffer. So intoxication, that's also sinful. That's now in India today, that's considered kind of chic to have a can of beer, to drink a few beers. That's considered wonderful, but it's not. It's pretty low class, actually. Previously in India, this was considered very low class, but India now, they're following the West. They think everything the Westerners do is so wonderful. So they're also drinking beer, and but it's horrible. I mean, this whole thing, getting intoxicated and talking all rubbish, urinating in the street and talking incoherently, all nonsense, driving and smashing the car up, drunken driving. I mean, what's so wonderful about this? Drinking, smoking is another nonsense. That you pay good money, you have to work hard to get money, and on the packet it says smoking kills, smoking is injurious to health. You're smoking, it's poisoning you, you're going to poison yourself. People are so crazy, they think this is something great. Stupid. Simply spending their money to poison themselves. But somehow or other it advertises being very sophisticated or whatever. So for some crazy reason people, they like to smoke. Even drinking tea and coffee, it's a, what is the need of all these things? Useless things. They're also habit forming. Therefore you become dependent upon them. You become ajitendriya. Your sense is uncontrolled. Therefore these things are all considered sinful. They have no relationship to the purpose of life. We should only eat and drink that which is necessary to maintain the body. That doesn't mean you can't eat and drink nicely, but why take intoxication? It's harmful to the body, it's habit forming, it's costly, it takes up, another thing is it takes up so much of the world is used for growing tobacco, coffee, tea, chocolate, all these useless things. Opium also, it's a big business, it's supposed to be illegal, but somehow or other billions and trillions of dollars of drugs are sold all over the world, and somehow or other the governments apparently aren't able to stop it. So much of the land of the world is used for growing all these things, which could be used for growing food, for instance. Same thing, meat. They're feeding the animals with grain. You have to feed, say, 20 kilos of grain to an animal to get 1 kilo of meat. So it's actually counterproductive to the interest of the human race.